The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
As we celebrate the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11's historic moon landing, I'm honored tonight to welcome Buzz Aldrin as our special guest this evening. After graduating third in his class at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, Mr. Aldrin spent time with the Air Force as a fighter pilot and later completed his doctorate in astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in just 3 years. In the 1960s, Mr. Aldrin was selected by NASA as one of its first astronauts, and he initiated the practice of being outfitted in scuba gear to train for weightlessness in space. On July 20, 1969, Mr. Aldrin and fellow astronaut Neil Armstrong landed the Apollo 11 spacecraft on the moon with a mere 20 seconds of fuel remaining. Upon his first observation upon exiting the spacecraft, Mr. Aldrin remarked, "Beautiful, beautiful, magnificent desolation." After returning, Mr. Aldrin was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He later wrote 2 books, Return to Earth and Men from Earth. He's also the founder of ShareSpace Foundation, a nonprofit organization devoted to opening the doors of space tourism to the public. In his newest book, Magnificent Desolation, Mr. Aldrin tells the behind-the-scenes story of the Apollo 11 mission, as well as his life afterward as he struggled with depression and alcoholism. Mr. Aldrin's going to be interviewed by Ian Sheffer, who has been a space exploration enthusiast since he was 3 years old. He told me that tonight. A third-year medical student at Temple University, Mr. Sheffer is also studying bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on a committee spearheading the effort to create a center for medical humanities at the university. We are truly honored to have them here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Buzz Aldrin and Ian Sheffer.
Thank you for everybody, to everybody for coming, and thank you to those of you upstairs watching on the simulcast. I guess Bill's provided us with a wonderful introduction, so we'll get right down to it. Buzz, what was it that made you want to become an astronaut?
I grew up in an aviation family. Didn't know anything really different. Dad flew airplanes, and I had my first ride in an airplane at age 2. Newark to Miami, and I got sick. So I'm told, but my older sister hadn't had her first ride, so I, as a veteran, went along with her and the second ride. Well, the first ride was very symbolic in a way because it was a Lockheed Vega high wing, maybe 12, 14 passengers, but it was owned by Standard Oil in New Jersey, and it was painted red and white so that the fuselage looked like the body of an eagle and the wings had feathers on them and everything. So it really was the symbol of our country and became the call sign of our lunar lander. The second one was also Standard Oil in New Jersey. It was an amphibian. And we had a picture in our basement of Amelia Earhart christening this thing. So my father was very closely associated with a lot of things. His physics professor was Robert Goddard. He had some things to do with getting Lindbergh to talk to Guggenheim to get Guggenheim to give some funds to Goddard to continue some of his rocket tests. He interrupted his doctor's degree at MIT at the end of World War I. He bootstrapped his way through flying. His first assignment in the Air Corps was in the Philippines as an aide to Billy Mitchell. It's where he met my mother, who's the daughter of an Army chaplain. Her name was Marion Moon. So Dad finished his doctorate and still in the service, commanded the commandant of the Air Corps Engineering School at McCook Field, which became Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, later Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And that engineering school became the Air Force Institute of Technology, which financed my doctor's degree at MIT later. But it was an aviation family, being a teenager during World War II, I was impressed with the military training for flying airplanes. And there, just as an aside, there wasn't any such thing as an Air Force Academy then. The Air Force Academy, or the Air Force, became a separate service kind of while I was at West Point in 1947. I was in the class of 51. As a separate service, they were taking 25% from Naval Academy, 25% from West Point into the Air Force. Naval Academy did it by lottery. West Point did it by class standing. So I was first in my class as a 17-year-old at a high school, the first year up there. I graduated third in the class, so obviously I got my choice of being in the Air Force. Went through pilot training finished gunnery training in Las Vegas at the end of 1952 and was in Korea during the Korean War in 1953. Shot down a couple airplanes, the other guy's airplanes. A guy did eject because his F-86 was on fire. So he had ejected, and the airplane without a pilot in it. We were hoping it would crash in the ocean, but it started turning back to go over land. And the flight leader missed his pass, so I had a couple of shots at it. And finally, I had some really great gun camera film for a while of me shooting down an F-86. Shortly after I was at the Air Force Academy as an aide to the dean of faculty, he got moved out with a faculty revolt, so I trained the upperclassmen who were second lieutenants because they were flying F-86s. Then I got a real plush assignment flying supersonic super sabers in Germany, best base you could pick then. And that's where I met a guy who was a good friend of mine at West Point, a member of the track team. He was a high hurdler, and I was a pole vaulter. We used to go in Madison Square Garden and kind of do our thing. We both went in the Air Force on graduation. He was a year behind me. Next time I run into him is over in Germany, and he says, "You got to get into this squadron. It has real good spirit." Well, this was Ed White, and he was later killed in the Apollo fire. But we flew together. He'd been over there a couple years before me, so he went back first, went through Michigan 2 years, test pilot school. Then he tells me in 1962, "I'm going to volunteer for this astronaut program." Well, by that time, I'd left Germany and gone to MIT and was beginning to write my thesis on manned orbital rendezvous. So I said, "I can shoot gunnery as well as Ed can." I'll volunteer too. But the difference was that I hadn't been through test pilot training because I sort of didn't see that career in the Air Force as what I wanted to pursue and be a stick and rudder guy and write down this thing. And anyway, there's some people who are just excellent diagnosticians of airplanes, and I didn't feel that I fit into that category. So I didn't elect to become a test pilot. But anyway, they couldn't select me, but they did Ed in the second group of nine. So we had seven, nine, and I was selected in the group of 14. and that makes 30 people. And those 30 people were really under consideration for the first few flights to the moon. So you just got to be in the right place at the right time. Some people dropped out, obviously, and later on they added more people. I hate for that to be a long answer, but I felt I could cover an awful lot of ground.
Thank you. It makes my job easier. Yes. You write in your new book, Magnificent Desolation, that you didn't have a whole lot of time while you were on the moon to reflect on the experience, and because of the military training, had been more focused on accomplishing the mission than, I think as you put it once, kind of jumping around and maybe tripping over the TV cable. I wonder, 40 years on, what is it about your experience in the Apollo program that stuck with you the most?
What was the word?
What is it about your experience in the Apollo program that's really stuck with you the most?
Stuck with me. Okay. Sure is good to be in the right place at the right time. And if something goes wrong somewhere, for it to play to your advantage. And that certainly happened to me several times. And contributed to my, again, being in the right place at the right time. Now, when you're an egghead from MIT and you're working with the training people trying to teach these hotshot test pilot Navy carrier landings guys how to do something, they eventually, in a kidding way, call you Dr. Rendezvous. And it's kind of poking fun, but it's also recognizing. What was the question?
What is it about your experience in the Apollo program that's stuck with
you?
Well,
it really was that so much in life depends upon, I hate to call it luck, because you can engineer a few things to maybe work in your way to your advantage, but if it doesn't, you just better accept it. I have a sponsor in my recovery program, and he says, when it's raining, love the rain, because it isn't going to change because you don't like it.
I was wondering, during your time at NASA, and obviously before you had joined the program, there was a lot of emphasis placed not only on meeting JFK's goal of landing a man on the moon by 1970, but also on beating the Russians. And a large part of the emphasis of the program was to make sure that we could demonstrate American superiority mm-hmm. in space technology. And I wonder, amongst all that, how did you and your fellow astronauts view your counterparts on the Russian side, the cosmonauts? Was it sort of a view of them being the arch enemies, or was it more like they were fellow explorers?
A little bit of both. Obviously, I was a Cold War warrior, on the front where if the siren had gone out and we'd fly low level into Poland, Czechoslovakia, and drop our nuclear weapon and head for Sweden and bail out, because our base wasn't going to be there. If they sent tanks through the Fulda Pass, we were at war with those guys. And I always felt like there may be a bit of camaraderie because people are fighter pilots no matter what they do. But I'd been in Korea and heard certain stories, and of course they've been very strongly confirmed later that the Russians were full bore into the Korean War. May have been a few Chinese, a couple of North Koreans maybe, but the Russians were really the key people in there, and some of our guys didn't come back and went to Russia for further interrogating. I felt, well, maybe there's some camaraderie here, but and of course, you're really interested in before. But we knew their technology a little bit, but not much. We were really concentrating on doing our own job. Knowing what they were doing didn't make all that much difference. We were a little curious when they'd have two spacecraft up there, and somebody would say, well, the distance varied back and forth. Well, I know why they do that, because I'm an orbital mechanics guy, and I know why it would do that sort of thing. But it was kind of interesting when they put two together and go in one and come out the other side. They were clearly doing things to demonstrate their prowess, and their first spacewalk almost was a disaster because Leonov had to depressurize his suit some, a little bit, to be able to get back in. And, of course, Ed White had a little trouble getting back in because he was pretty tall. He was the first American spacewalker. So we reacted to their things, and we caught up with them pretty much during the Gemini program. And we got into Apollo, and he had the Apollo fire just 2 months after my first flight in Gemini 12 with Jim Lovell, where, because of the spacewalk difficulties, someone suggested that maybe we could train in the neutral buoyancy of being underwater. Well, I understood exactly what that meant because I'd been a scuba diver since 1957, and I welcomed that. And so because of that kind of training and improvement of foot restraints, I was able to help end the Gemini program with very successful space walking record. And I was a rendezvous guy. Well, we did that. We actually had a failure of radar and took the backup solution instead of the computer solution or the Houston solution. So, but no big deal. Everybody knew it was going to work because I had something to do with it.
How's it felt seeing those former rivals become such close friends and partners in the U.S. space program?
Well, I'm glad you added that because I feel I didn't answer the question quite that much. But I was very skeptical, and I was on travel when Apollo Soyuz docked together in 1957. And I saw the film taken from the Apollo spacecraft of our spacecraft doing the maneuver, doing the active rendezvous and the active approach. And because there was a different atmosphere in both spacecraft, we built an interim place, an interim cabin in the front of the Apollo spacecraft. So it was a little bit different than the normal docking. You had to dock with this thing sitting out in front. But it approached and docked, and it was smooth as could be, and it came in and hard docked. And during a press conference from the ground, some reporter asked Leonov how he felt when the American spacecraft came and docked. And, of course, reporters love to ask the question, how did it feel? Whether you're a mother and your child was just run over in the car by a car in front of you, they always want to know, what did it feel like? Well, Leonov said, well, I saw the American craft approach, and when it docked, I was jumped around, and I had great fear for the safety of our spacecraft. Well, when something like that happens, you know you've just been had. And they get down on the ground, and they quote people. And Leonov says, the space race is over. It's a draw. Well, it wasn't over, and it certainly wasn't a draw. And I hosted two cosmonauts later on, and they just out and out lied to the public. Because when they came over, we knew that they had never invited anybody to see their rocket launch. So we intended to invite them down to see Cape Kennedy and see what was going on. So we felt we had to have two plans, one of them that included going down to Cape Kennedy and the other one that didn't. So we asked them, and they said, no, we just as soon not visit your launch site. So we took them on the other trip. Now, before they went back to Moscow, there was a press conference in New York, and a reporter said, how come you didn't visit the American launch site? And the guy said, we were not asked. And I was walking around back, and I couldn't believe. But the answer depends on the audience. It depends on who you're talking to, what the truth is. The truth changes. And that's a culture. And I think we see that culture throughout the Middle East significantly.
I just want to go back to your book for a bit. You write that it took you quite a while to seek treatment for your depression, and it was something that you initially had tried to cover up by saying that you were in the hospital instead of getting psychiatric treatment, going in for evaluation for neck surgery. And I'm wondering, how did you make the transition from trying to hide that to being so open and so public about it and eventually becoming an advocate for those with suffering from depression and alcoholism?
Well, after I retired, I had some advisors. I forget where they came from, but they were in a law firm. And they said, I still stayed up at Edwards in government quarters, even though I had retired until my kids got out of school. So they lined up a commercial for me, be a spokesman for a commercial. It was for a Volkswagen computer system inside the Volkswagen that would tell, when you plug it into a station, the station sheet of paper would tell you all sorts of things. And part of this commercial was this Volkswagen. This computer tells me that this Volkswagen's battery needs water. I'm impressed. $300,000. I was sure impressed. And they didn't even use the commercial to use up my image, unfortunately, because the computer wasn't ready when the new model came out. So I felt this civilian life is going to be pretty good. And maybe I ought to write a story about how things have been going in my life. I was beginning to feel fairly confident about it, but I was still seeking psychiatric care. So the writer that somebody put in front of me was a writer for the LA Times, and he said, well, I don't know whether there's really a book here or not. It's a fascinating career. Let's write an op-ed piece for the LA Times. So we did that, and the reaction across the country was so supportive for an astronaut walking on the moon talking about needing psychiatric care for depression after things didn't maybe go his way or he inherited whatever it was. So we wrote the book, and the book came out. From the op-ed piece, I was on the board of directors of the National Association for Mental Health. The book came out, and now I'm chairman of National Association of Mental Health. So I go around the country encouraging people to seek treatment and talking to different places. Not exactly the career I had in mind, becoming a fighter pilot or one that went to the moon, was to talk about depression and recovery. After a while, it became clearly obvious after the book was written that there was more to it than that, more to it what I had inherited, because I was quite aware of the situation when my mother committed suicide a year before I went to the moon, and her unhappiness, disillusion, for whatever the reason was. And when the book that I wrote came out, they decided to make a movie of the week, and Cliff Robertson was going to play my part. So when he came down to find out who Buzz Aldrin really is, I was in my first rehab. And there were three or four more that took place. It was not an easy thing to do. And it really required coming down from a very high pedestal. And being a military guy, I learned how to take orders, especially as a plebe at West Point. So when I don't have the answer for what's going wrong, I'll begin to let somebody else maybe tell me. And that's the key to doing things, and it's the key to recovery, is they help you and you help them, and by helping them, you get out of yourself, you get out of thinking about what your problems are and paying attention to somebody else on the outside. And it's a miraculous program, but it was very, very, very challenging back in those days. And you're never immune from any of this stuff. The genes are still there, and they're still active, and they still come back occasionally to haunt you. You just have to have an insurance pad going with people that you associate with.
Just to come back to the space program as we wrap it up, and we'll open it up for questions from the audience in just a bit. You say in your book that the space program in the 60s really kind of gave a world that was in a good bit of turmoil something to focus on that was positive and that was able to bring people together and generated unparalleled excitement. I was wondering, do you think that excitement was something that was unique to the culture of the 60s, or do you think it's something that we can recapture?
No, I think the world conditions were very unique and aren't apt to come back in that kind of way, especially in a endeavor that is so in its infancy. We put a satellite into orbit. That shocks the world. How could the Russians possibly do this? That means if they can do that, they can send a nuclear weapon in to our country. And ours aren't doing too well, so we got to do something, catch up, symbolize to the world and symbolize to our own people the progress and the strength that we really have. It took us a long time, well, not really a long time, but the country reacted pretty fast after Pearl Harbor to respond to that kind of a threat. And once having been spurred on, we responded very quickly too. But it took a convincing number of things. A dog going up there with the Russians. They go by the backside of the moon and take photographs and name all the craters about Russian historical figures. And then, of course, the crowning insult, in a way, was we're trying to get our people ready, but our rockets just aren't working. And all of a sudden, some young farmer's son orbits the Earth once and becomes a hero of the Soviet Union, Yuri Gagarin. And all we can do is put a guy on a smaller rocket and go up and down, Alan Shepard. The next summer, we were able to do that again with Gus Grissom, but it wasn't until February of 62 that that John Glenn was able to fly several orbits of the Earth. So we were really kind of reacting in a hurry with very unusual circumstances. Now, can that happen again? I don't think it can or should with a race, but I think it ought to be generated by something that maybe has to adjust itself to the times of a little recession, but the times that are critical, I think, are having embarked on a program called the Vision for Space Exploration, which is set to finish the space station, retire the orbiter, build a new spacecraft, get to the moon by 2020. Maybe that hasn't been implemented in quite the right way. We've seen it kind of run into a few little troubles already in cost overruns. We have to cut other things in order to fund what we're doing because it wasn't very well funded. And maybe it's time, as a guy I got to know pretty well, when I moved out of Montclair, New Jersey, Yogi Berra moved in. And Yogi and I were both in put in the New Jersey Hall of Fame. And Yogi says, well, one thing I repeat frequently is it's never over till it's over. and I'm still waiting for it to be over, whatever it is. But if there's a fork in the road, take it. Well, whether there was or not, we took it after the Columbia accident, because we only had three. And we took it and came up with a pretty enlightened program in general terms. But the implementation hasn't been all that right. So maybe we take advantage of what we've done since we took the fork in the road, but maybe think, do we want to keep doing that fork in the road, or do we want to cut over, take an advantage? We don't want to go back to the fork and sit around in low Earth orbit, whether that's a solution or not. We can jump over, take advantage, find a different path, a different fork in the road. And I think that fork in the road is to do something, to go boldly where man has not gone before. Star Trek. We need to inspire people. And if it takes longer, gee, that's maybe good, because we're not ready to throw a lot of money at it right now. But there are some crucial things that we have to do. And if we can revise the implementation problems and solve some money, then we can get some things done and turn over the landing on the moon to internationals, China, India. You know, people in media want to promote a race between us and China. What kind of a race is that? We already brought home the bacon 40 years ago. Why would we want to have a race to be second against somebody who wants to be first? I mean, they can beat us like that. All they got to do is fly around the moon once. We're not going to do that. We got to build up something if we go there. Very expensively build it up. And is there justification for humans on the surface of the moon? We can do things pretty well automatically, but if you're looking for prestige, if you're looking for going down in history as having advanced people as far as your enslaved people go, you do those things and convince them that you're the country that's going to be supreme in the 21st century. So my theme is U.S. global space leadership. And there's some things I'd like to see, but I got to get somebody else to push those, and that's landing on the runway after we retire the orbiter. But it's the destination that's important. Don't go to where you've been before. Take our experience and our recent experience and somehow offer it to the international and look for commercial, eventually, developments, if there are any on the moon, that can pay for habitation or support people being there if they really need to be there. It's a bad place. I ought to know. I've been there.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to take
I just got hold of NASA's mission to Mars. And I said to the guy, does it involve anything to do with stopping at the moon of Mars first? No. I mean, that's the strategic kingpin of my strategy. We move to places that are progressively exciting, fly by comets, intercept asteroids, land on them, look at them, show pictures back to Earth. It's inspiring what you can do before we could ever land on the moon. And you keep doing those kind of things. And then you go to the moon of Mars and you occupy it for three times, because we can do great good there, safer, and bring the people back. And then eventually we're ready to have a permanence. Now, it's debatable as to what a permanence really means. But if you go once, come back, go twice, come back, I can guarantee you the money will be changed and it'll become earmarks for somebody in the Congress. Once we've done that a couple times, I'll say, no, we've done that. And everything we've done to support that will be wasted. Now, we didn't waste money beating the Russians going to the moon. It ended the Cold War. If you think about it carefully, it really did. So you can tell I'm not a cold fish about this. I'm enthusiastic about the opportunity. Why? Well, because it's what I think we ought to do, but it's the chance, it's the challenge for me to try and make a bigger difference than I ever did by being fortunate enough to walk on the moon in the footsteps of Neil Armstrong.
Well, thank you very much, Buzz. So why don't we take some questions from the audience. And we've got volunteers circulating in on both sides of the auditorium with microphones. So if you just raise your hand and wait until you're called on, I'll call on you. And wait until you have the microphone in your hand so that everyone can hear you and the folks upstairs can hear you as well. Do try and keep your questions brief so that we can get to...
If the answer can be yes or no, it's even better.
There you go. And also do try to phrase them in the form of a question. So... See, young man right there in the corner in the blue shirt.
What does a kid have to do to become an astronaut?
What did you say?
What does a kid have to do to become an astronaut?
Study hard. No, you got to have patience. You got to have something that makes you special in the eyes of other people. You have to be able to communicate. Do you Twitter? Try Twitter at the real Buzz. Okay. Do you rap? Try downloading iTunes, the Rocket Experience. Patience and something special. Communication, more than ever, because of longer duration flights, the piloting skill is not as important as being a team member, getting along with people, small group, and being a contributing, not a dominant, not a big follower, but a real happy-go-lucky team member contributing.
Thank you. Next question. Just here on the house right, second in. There you are. The black polo shirt.
Buzz, thanks for being here. I was 8 years old when I watched you land on the moon, so I've gotten a little older, but it's a real treat to see you in person. My question is, when you were approaching the moon on Apollo 11, how confident were you that it was going to be successful and you were actually going to be able to come back?
Well, the most hazardous part of the mission is launch from Earth. I mean, if things go wrong, they're going to go wrong in a hurry and you got to do something. The biggest concern is drifting and colliding with the tower, because that hydrogen and oxygen, you got to get out of there in a big hurry. That's a big fireball. And that's why the rocket is controlled by the launch people until tower clear, and then the transfer control goes to Houston. The engines are going to function. They're going to shut down, you hope. If they don't, you've got things to do, hopefully, to maybe save the mission and save your life. We figured that the confidence level for safely returning, whether we succeeded or not, was 95%. Those were the numbers that people kind of worked to. And those are not bad numbers when you've been in combat and deal with things that can go wrong in a hurry in flying hot, high-performance aircraft. Now, can we successfully complete the mission? That means everything has to work up to the point of landing. I guess we felt people may dispute that in the media, that it would have been very successful if we just landed and then for some reason something went wrong and we had to lift off 2 hours later when Mike Collins came over again and we could rendezvous with him. That would have been a successful mission. We didn't have to get outside, but the media and everybody thinks that's absolutely the most important thing to do is to put your feet on the moon. You got to get there first before you can put your feet on the moon. And once you do, once you get there, you've opened the door to everything else in exploration. Everything else in the space program, you can land different places, you can do different, you can land again at the same place. But until you've made that first landing and convinced people that we know how to do that and executing it, you can be good at walking around on the surface all you want, because that's easy to do. We demonstrated that it's easier under a little bit of gravity to move around than it is under zero gravity, where you float around, you don't really have control of yourself. But, you know, that doesn't affect the way people respond to what they're geared to do by gold medals in the Olympics, by the media and other people who pay attention to first instead of get the job done.
Okay. Lady in the very back row, I think you've had your hand up for quite a bit. Yeah. Just wait for the microphone just a moment.
I'm sorry if I said something that irritated you.
No, not at all. 5 years ago, I brought my kids to the White House, and you read a story to them about your book, To the Moon. And they sat a few feet in front of you, and I want to say thank you. They loved your book. They're here with it, by the way. But we loved your book. My husband, who's waiting in line to get your autograph, when we started dating 25 years ago, has a whole binder with all the astronauts and all their autographs. When he was 8 years old, wrote all of you and got your autographs. So thank you. My question is, too, what colors did you see when you were on the moon? Last night, I kept my kids up to 11:30 to watch all the reenactments 40 years ago when I was 10 years old. And how would you inspire someone of my generation to get my children's interest in science? They do have an interest in science. I push it. I encourage it. They love it. But mm-hmm. Anything you could recommend, I would appreciate.
I think we can teach people science by giving them a role model and experience that challenges the nation, challenges people to carry that out. We did that in the 60s, and I think we have to really bend over backwards to do that again, to challenge people to really engage in things that the country is behind in. And NASA knows that, and so do teachers. And it's STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. We've got to improve those things. But are we going to cancel our space program to do that? That's the very thing that motivated so many people. Young kids like dragons and astronauts. Well, there aren't any dragons around. Do you want to take all the astronauts away from them, too? There was an early part of the question, and I...
She had asked about what colors you had seen
colors.
On the moon.
Well, except for what we brought in a colorful orange and yellow and black and flags and such. The moon itself was shades of gray depending on the sun angle. When you get close to it, it's all the same. The dust has the same color and everything is the same. The sky is black. There's a colorful world up there called Earth. And that's the only color that's there other than what we brought with us. So the fact that we had a black and white TV, don't bother if all you had was a black and white TV. So if there's color on the moon, it'll be because we take it there.
Okay, another question. A gentleman in the center here with the goatee.
Yeah.
Just hold on for the mic for just a moment so we can... make sure the folks upstairs can hear.
Hi, Buzz. It's great to meet you. My name's Tom Karp. I'm a huge space buff fan, and the biggest thing that I, to this day, that amazes me the most is the fact that the average calculator that you can buy in Walmart is more powerful than the computer that ran the lunar module and everything. Have you embraced technology at your age? I know you Twitter. I know some people... Do you have an iPod? What do you have on your iPod?
I keep hearing that from people.
What do you have on your iPod?
I think number one, it's just indicative of how much we got out of space program. No, ICBMs, ballistic missiles. We had to compress all the electronics so small, and we give NASA the credit for that. We did need Velcro, yeah. And now it gets stuck the wrong way whenever. But, you know, I can get a new BlackBerry every 6 months, or a Pilot, or an iPhone. But you can't build rockets that fast. We haven't learned how to do that. The testimony to me is not how much we have advanced, but how much did we get out of so little capability back then. I can throw my BlackBerry in the air, and it can't send 1,000 different readings on the systems that it's in touch with back to Houston like that, and it can't take a star sighting and align its platform. It can't calculate the delta V, the velocity change that's needed to get back to Earth at a certain point. It can't land on a foreign place. It depends on all these programs were built into there with inputs by the crew, not just to happen automatically, but everything can get updated by transmission from Houston to put new information in there. The worst failure we could have is communication failure, so they couldn't help us decide what's going on. We had to work with the computer because it didn't... it came with an instruction book, okay? You didn't have to go to the computer to for it to tell you what to do with it, which is what you do today because you got so much you don't need an instruction book. It's in the computer or it's in the iPhone. So I have mixed feelings when somebody says that, but it is a great testament to what we have and how rapidly it is changing. But let me challenge you with something. Somebody wants to do a little math quickly. From Kitty Hawk to Tranquility Base, 1903 to 1969, 66 years. All right, add 66 to 1969, and what do you get? 2035. Do we want to be kicking up dust on the moon again, 66 years later, after we accelerated so fast in the last century? No, I don't think so. I think my schedule gets us there in 2031, and that's a pretty complete schedule. It'll allow for a little bit of slippage here and there, but it's a very enticing schedule of inspiring sets of activities, which really let you go down that route to get to Mars. But by the 50th anniversary, if we change our mind, and I hope the president won't, because he won't go down in history far more than Kennedy did for kicking up dust on the moon that never sustained itself. But the world leader that commits to a pathway that ends up with creatures on the Earth occupying another planet in the solar system, I got to tell you, that is a big deal historically. Now, but by the 50th anniversary, if we want to go to the moon because we found something, we can do that. Or we can go to an asteroid and get the minerals, or we can go to the next step, the moon of Mars, and then a little later on, as we're progressing in that, learn more about Mars, we can then make another commitment that we're going to go to the surface to stay. And if we're not ready to do that, then don't go, because it'll be a waste. Those are the kind of mature decisions we have to make. But I need right now support for a relatively conservative schedule in the very near future, providing we make the right decisions and save a little here and there and let the internationals do things at the moon. But I need support because without it, during the campaign, the candidate of change, early in the campaign, said education is so important to me. My education policy is so important. Somebody asked me, how are you going to pay for it? Well, I think I'll put the space program on hold for 5 years. Just check the history. When the candidate found out how many votes were involved in Florida, Alabama, Texas, and California, California is a lock-in anyway, the tune changed. But now he's elected, and hopefully there will be an open option selection, and the people will get to express a point of view. Just today on NASA Watch, a CBS poll said over 50% of the people think we should go to Mars. I don't think we should stay in low Earth orbit just looking back at Earth to confirm that we're the culprits for climate change. Climate has changed a long time, but you know, I can't say that if I want to get listened to, because that's not politically correct. So I got to change my spots.
All right, we have time for just a few more questions. See, it's the lady right there on the right in the
no media here,
black shirt. There you go.
Hi, I'm just thrilled to be here and meet you. There is that very famous picture of you standing on the moon with Neil Armstrong reflected in the visor. But when I was at space camp, they told us a story about what you were actually doing when the picture was taken. I've since heard other pictures about your kinked line for your urine collector. I think that's a charming story, if you'd like to repeat that.
Buy the book. But I will give you an answer, because I know the picture you're talking about. And about 10 years ago in L.A., there was an award given for photography, unusual photography, and you know I was asked to come, and people explained what was significant about the photography, the picture that they took. And I said, I've only got three words that describe that. Location, location, location.
Great. Take another few questions.
Oh, you know what comedy is? Comedy is taking a normal situation, throwing in an absurdity, and then act as if nothing was unusual. No kidding. So when you're on the moon getting ready to leave, and Houston says, Tranquility Base, you're cleared for liftoff. And we knew we were. I said, Roger, Houston, we're number one on the runway. That's two.
Gentleman back here on the right-hand side. I'm sorry, house left. Just other side. There you are.
Hi, Mr. Aldrin. In a world that's had very few heroes, when I was a 14-year-old boy, I watched you walk on the moon, and I watched Gemini when you walked in space. So it's a special treat for me to be here this evening. I have a question to ask. Is that I know the story of landing on the moon, and I know the dramatic moments where we were down to little fuel and everything else. And I know that the people made all the difference, you and the other astronauts making the decisions. Now people are talking about going into space without people on board. sending probes, sending unmanned, that why should we risk people in space? But I really wonder if we would have the successes we had if we didn't have people like Neil Armstrong and yourself making the decisions, taking the risks. And there seems to be an unwillingness to take risks. And I'm wondering how you answer those people who say, well, why should we be risking people in space or further beyond and towards Mars?
We went there so that Neil and I could be first and Leonov might not be there first. I know Alexei and other people. He was scheduled to be the first cosmonaut on the moon. The Russians want to go to Mars, maybe jointly with us, because that way they can con us into paying for it. Right now, there is a program in Russia called Project 500, where they took seven people just the other day and put them together in solitude for 120 days. And the reason it's 500 is because they're going to build up to 500, and these people have communication lag, what it would take in communicating from Mars back to Earth for this time period. They are training people right now to go to Mars. There is a mission called Phobos Grunt. Phobos is the inner moon of Mars. They've tried to send missions there many times in the past. This one has a Chinese satellite that will orbit, and it doesn't just go there. It picks up material and brings it back, and it has French cooperation, and the French just signed an agreement that they will get some samples when the Russians bring this back in exchange for their helping to track it there. Now, what are we doing? We're planning to go back to the moon to kick up dust. I just don't think that we can sit back. The Chinese, the Indians for sure are going to go back to the moon or go to the moon. And the Russians are not going to go to the moon. Why would they want to go to the moon and be 50 years after the race that they lost? They're not going to do that. They're going to help somebody else do that to try and show up the U.S. That this is not a sugar daddy world. It's a competitive world of economics, of control of people. And all the rest of those things that are not real great testimony to the kindness of human beings. We're still pretty crude, competitive vultures when it comes to controlling people and trying to exert their religion on you or dominate and patience take over. Well, they've never had a parade for a robot.
Fine answer. We have time for one last question.
You may inspire people who create the robots to study harder so that they can go create robots, but that somehow that doesn't quite jazz up the nation as far as the excess of humans doing things. And more we have to work together with the robots because they're still not that smart, especially if they're a long ways away and it takes a long time to communicate instructions to them to do things. They got to be pretty damn conservative. The spirit and opportunity that have lasted 5 years on Mars instead of 90 days, what they've done in 5 years... some controllers told me we could have done in 4 months or less if we had had human intelligence in orbit around Mars to communicate directly, to control those robots directly. So there's a place for robots, there's a place for people. We don't send people on expendable missions. We send robots out there. We put the Hubble telescope up there to spend a lot of time sitting there looking at different stuff. You don't send a human there. You go and fix it if you need to, and that's what humans can do miraculously. And we're going to send new telescopes to further distances. But the people will go there and fix them, or we'll bring the telescope back to some place where we can fix them. There's a place where we really have to work together and be aware of the speed of light, because that's the speed of instructions. And the closest sun to us is 4.3 light years away. That's a long time. One-way communication.
We have time for one last question, then. Okay. Gentleman, straight back with white hair. Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, me too.
In your 66-year timeline from Kitty Hawk to Tranquility Base, there was a lot of commercial development that's yeah. really helped make it possible. What do you see? You've talked a lot about politically oriented and government-sponsored exploration. What do you see as a future for commercial space operations?
Rockets and spacecraft that are reliable are very expensive. It takes a lot to test them. There may be breakthroughs. I'm not sure what they are. We've got to keep plodding away with testing, really checking things out to make sure that they are reliable. That's very expensive. Suborbital up into space and back down again. If you consider the speed that they go over the top and what you have to have in orbit, 17,000 miles an hour, they need 300 times the energy expenditure to get into orbit. That's tough to do. And only three nations in the world have been able to do that with the full power of their nation behind it. To do it in your backyard or a small corporation, that's a really tough thing. My son says, like pulling rabbits out of a hat, to be able to say you can do that and then get the government to pull a lot of money. Maybe some of these people who have damn good ideas and talent, maybe they can do what the big companies and the government people do. We need a partnership, really, to make it work. But we need a subject to make it work. And that's what I want to see happen. A subject is a common universal, international, runway landing spacecraft for 6 or 8 people, much, much smaller than the shuttle, a mini shuttle, U.S. developed with the inputs from other countries, with commercial commercial shortcuts and whatever, but a lot of financing from the government, a lot of help in the development. We need that kind of partnership. We don't need the government, NASA, saying, I want cargo to the station, and whoever will give it to me the cheapest, I'll sign a contract. Because what will you get for people? You'll get Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. You get a capsule landing in the ocean. And we've seen the shuttle land for 28 years now successfully on a runway. That's what we need for U.S. leadership. But I got to get somebody else to get enthusiastic about that. I'll help them. But I don't want to confuse people, because the destination is the most important thing. And rather than Mars being something we can do within a decade, we can't do that. We don't have the economy to start out with that kind of a spurt right now. We have to do the right decisions, and then when we are able to finance something. And it'll take a little bit more than 2 decades. If we ever make it by the 60th anniversary of landing on the moon, that's 2029, I'll be surprised. And I'll also be 99 years old.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Fuzzle will be signing books upstairs, and is a signing line underway now. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.